Did you know you were speaking this morning?
I'm sorry?
Oh, did you know you were going to be speaking this morning?
No, I was just basking in all the adulation. Well, thank you, Bill, very much. Indeed, it's been an enormous pleasure for us to be involved on the periphery, I must admit, but being involved in the life and ministry of Christ the Rock. We brag on you in many different parts of the United States and around the world, because we believe that God has done a unique work in this particular area. And we think that Christ the Rock has manifested many, many things that bring glory to God and great blessing to the Fox Valley. So it's our pleasure, and thank you for inviting us to come here on occasions. We are so old now that most people think we're dead. And Bill and Jan are just a couple of the people who say not only are they not dead, but they do have a little bit of life left in them. And so we're happy to come and share it with you today. Bill, what time is that thing counting down at 33 minutes? So that I got 33 minutes left. Okay, good. I announced that to you so that you know what it is you've got ahead of you, either to look forward to or to tolerate. But let's get underway. I understand that you have been spending some time in the Old Testament book of Esther. And when Bill invited me to come up and speak this weekend, he not only invited me to come, he also told me you were studying Esther and I should preach from Esther. Well, I have a confession to make for you. If I continue preaching until November of this year, I will celebrate 70 years of preaching the gospel. No, I'm only halfway through the sentence, but let me start the sentence again. If I continue going until November of this year, I will celebrate the 70th anniversary of my first attempt at preaching. During those 70 years, never once have I attempted to preach from the book of Esther. If you have been studying Esther for the last number of weeks, which I believe you have, you are way ahead of me in what you know about Esther. So come at the end of the service and correct me where that is necessary. But with that in mind, let me try and bring a message to you that will be relevant and applicable to us not living in a Jewish community that was in exile in Persia thousands of years ago. But what is the relevance of this to us living in the Fox Valley in the 21st century in the United States of America? I want to talk first of all about the actual story of Esther. I know that you know this, but let me just briefly summarize it for you. The scene of the story of Esther is in ancient Persia. Now, if you're following the news right now, you know a lot of the turmoil in the Middle East is going on in the same regions that the Jewish people were in exile thousands of years ago. The Babylonians had come, and they had destroyed the temple in Jerusalem, and they destroyed Jerusalem itself. They had taken off many, many, many of the Jewish people into exile, back into their homeland. And for 70 years, the Jewish people suffered under the domination of the Babylonians. And then a degree of rescue, redemption came for the Jewish people in that the Babylonians were themselves overthrown by the Persians. And the Persians became more benevolent to the Jewish people. Jeremiah wrote a letter to them, and it's recorded for us in Jeremiah chapter 29. And he told the exiles that whilst they could understandably be disgruntled about being taken away from their homeland and living under the domination of people they didn't like, who were treating them unkindly, nevertheless, the people in exile were as much as possible to live in such a way that they weren't just a thorn in the flesh for their captors, but they would actually contribute to the well-being of the community of which they were a part. But God made it very clear to the Jewish people that whilst they were to make the best of the situation living in exile, they were not to settle down there. This was not what God had planned for them. They were going to be in this place of judgment because of their sin for approximately 70 years. But God's plan was that they should return, rebuild Jerusalem, rebuild the temple, and reinstitute the worship of the Lord as he had ordained it. Well, the time did come where under the Persians they were granted freedom to return to Jerusalem if they so desired. And many of them did, and it was a very, very difficult situation. We know the story from Ezra and Nehemiah of what it was like for the returning exiles to start rebuilding the walls and rebuilding Jerusalem and rebuilding the temple. But there were a lot of the Jewish people who apparently had taken Jeremiah to heart and not only had settled down to do the best that they could living in a bad situation and seek to be of benefit to the people who were their captors, but they had settled down, and they kind of liked it there. And they got themselves in a situation which was not what God had planned for them, not had ordained. And it was in that community of exiled Jews who could have returned and should have returned and didn't return that the story of Ezra takes place. Very interesting to try and figure out what the spiritual condition of these Jews who were living in Persia really was at that time. For one of the strangest things about the book of Esther, of course, is that God is never mentioned once in the whole book. And many people have questioned whether this book actually belongs in the scriptures at all. And many people read it and say, what is the lesson that we're supposed to learn from that? Well, in this situation, living under the Persians, the Jewish remnant of exiles were finding themselves in a very precarious situation. We don't need to go into all the details, but there was somebody who was an arch enemy of the Jewish people. And this man's name was Haman. Haman was a descendant of King Agag. King Agag was a member of a tribal group called the Amalekites. The Amalekites were the sworn enemies of Israel, going way back to the days of Moses and Aaron and Joshua. And God had said, after the children of Israel, now not going into exile, but coming out of Egypt and moving into the promised land, they were now confronting the inhabitants of the land of promise. And God had told them, this is hard for us to understand, but God had told them the only way that the people of Israel would settle in the promised land was by basically getting rid of all the people who are already living there, including the Amalekites. Well, that meant that right from the very beginning, the people of Israel coming out of Egypt, going through the wilderness and coming into the land of promise, ran up against the Amalekites, who were not welcoming to these people from Israel, these people of Israel coming into their land, and they started to fight. And the fighting was very bitter and it was very cruel. And in the end, God makes an amazing thing. He says the Amalekites are going to fight us and resist us from generation to generation to generation. Well, that prediction was absolutely true. That is precisely what began to happen. And after many years, you remember that Israel didn't want to operate as a theocracy where God would rule the nation through the prophets. They wanted a monarchy. They wanted a king because everybody else had a king. And so Saul was anointed king. Saul was a Benjaminite. That means he was of the tribe of Benjamin. Now then, the tribe of Benjamin producing, among others, King Saul. King Saul becomes king when the Amalekites are still fighting them. And in the end, God says, you have got to destroy the Amalekites. They are bent on destroying you. You are to destroy them. Saul went about it, but he only half did the job, if you remember. And as a result, he only half did what God had told him to do. And delayed obedience is disobedience, and semi-obedience is disobedience. And so Saul lost his job. And Samuel finished off the job for him, for in that he did not finish off the Amalekites, he spared their king Agag. Agag, however, thought he was home and dry, but he confronted the prophet Samuel, and Samuel, amazingly, he oversees the execution of King Agag and the destruction of the Amalekites. You say, what in the world does this have to do with anything? Haman, the sworn enemy of the Jewish people, was a sworn enemy of the Jewish people because he was a descendant of King Agag, who was an Amalekite. And the Amalekites, for generation after generation after generation, had hated the Jews. Mordecai, who was one of the Jewish people who was living under the Persians, he was a descendant of Benjamin. And King Saul was a descendant of Benjamin, and it was the Benjaminites who had got rid of the Agites. And so here we have two people coming up against each other thousands of years later in the kingdom of Persia, and they are now personified, not in a tribal group called the Amalekites, and another tribal group called the Benjamites, on which there has been a generations-long feud, now is personified in two men. And they hate each other, Haman and Mordecai. Now, Mordecai is a nobody in the exile. Haman is going up and up and up and up, climbing the food chain until he is second only to the king. And one day, through a set of circumstances, he is confronted with Mordecai, and Mordecai refuses to acknowledge Haman. And Haman, who has got all kinds of power but a very, very weak ego, he can't handle Mordecai's outright despising of him and refusal to acknowledge him. He finds out that Mordecai is not only a Jew, but he finds out he's a Benjaminite, and the old Amalekite in him is stirred up against the Benjaminite in Mordecai, and he says, I'm going to have that man dead. And not only am I going to have him dead, bearing in mind what the Israelites did to my people, the Amalekites, I am going to have the Jewish people exterminated. In other words, the word we would use is there's going to be a Jewish Holocaust. They are going to be annihilated. And that is the situation that we find in the story of Esther. Mordecai finds out that this is going to happen. And he immediately takes off his normal clothes. He dresses himself in sackcloth. He pours ashes all over his head. And he goes around wailing and mourning for his people, Israel. Now it just so happens that Mordecai previously had adopted a young child, a relative of his. And this young child is now grown up into be a young woman. She's not any old young woman. How can you have an old young woman? What a good thing I'm listening to me. He wasn't any old. She wasn't any old young woman. She was actually a knockdown, beautiful young girl. The king of the Persians, a guy called Ahasuerus, or the Greeks fortunately called him Xerxes, so we'll call him old Zerk. I call him Zerk the Jerk. Anyway, King Xerxes. King Xerxes has got bent out of shape by his wife, so they got rid of her. They were not a very nice family. He got rid of her, decided he would replace her, didn't go to one of the noble women in the place. He has a beauty contest. Calls in, bring all the beautiful girls in the area, prepare them for me. I'll have a night with them one at a time, and I'll decide who's the most beautiful and who's the best in bed. It's a Bible story, guys. I told you some people wonder why it's in the Bible. But anyway, this is how this noble king goes about replacing his wife, whom he has deposed because she won't parade herself to satisfy him and his drunken guests. This young girl, who actually finds herself in the harem and finds herself being prepared for the one night with the king, and it takes them over a year to prepare her. This is sick, so we won't go into it. Eventually, she is chosen, she becomes queen. So Mordecai, who sits outside in his ashes and his sackcloth, is actually the guardian of the queen. And he goes into his mourning and his wailing so much that in the end, word comes even into the harem. This crazy guy, Mordecai, is going around saying the Jews are going to be annihilated. And it comes to Esther's ears. Now, Esther has a problem. She is a closet Jewess. She has never admitted to being a member of the despised Jewish people. Mordecai gets word to her, and he says, "You've got to understand something, Esther. If the Jewish people are exterminated, annihilated, if there's a Holocaust, you're going to be part of it. But God has opened the way." Well, he doesn't say God, because God's never mentioned in this story. "You are in a position of incredible power. You are the queen. You have the ear of the king. You have got to do something, and you have got to help the Jewish people survive this terrible, terrible situation." She understandably is a little nervous about this, because these crazy persons have all kinds of rules and regulations. And the rules and regulations that she is concerned about is this: even the queen cannot go into the king's presence without the king inviting her there. And if she would do that, she was punished by death. Now, Mordecai is putting pressure on her from the outside, sending messages to her and saying, you have got to do something about this. I believe that you have been brought to this moment in history. I believe that you are where you are for such a time as this. And Esther says, well, that's all very well for him. But if I show up in front of the king to try and ask him for him to save my people, he's going to wonder why I want to know that. And then it'll be clear that I'm a Jewess. I have no idea how he's going to react to that. And if I go into his presence without being invited into his presence, I automatically come under a potential death sentence. But in the end, she decides she's got to do it. And so she comes out with the immortal words, I'll go and do it, and if I perish, I perish. If I perish, I perish. She shows herself in the king's presence. She doesn't go walking into his presence. She puts herself in a position where he can't avoid seeing her. She has gussied herself up. And remember, she is a gorgeous woman. And so I don't know what she did. We're spared the details. But she makes it absolutely certain he cannot miss her. And he is so pleased with her that he forgets his own rules, and he extends his gold scepter to her and invites her into his presence. And he says she is so pleased, he's so pleased with her, he'll give her anything up to half his kingdom. What does she want? And amazingly, she just says she wants to have dinner with him. Well, he's thinking, handle that all right. They seem to go from banquet to banquet, these people, by the way. He must have been 350 pounds, this king. So he goes, they have the meeting. But he, of course, brings his buddy Haman in. You remember Haman, the Agagite, the Amalekite, who hates the Jews because they have a blood feud? You remember that? Okay. He is sitting there with the king and Esther, and the three of them have this nice meal together. And so he reminds her, you please me so much. I think you're just absolutely my wonderful queen, my favorite concubine. I've got lots to choose from. You are numero uno. What do you want? And she said, I'd like to have dinner with you again tomorrow. I'd like to have dinner again with you tomorrow. Well, a whole series of things going, to cut the long story short, which has gone on too long right now. The net result of this is Haman, who is so bent out of shape with Mordecai, decides to get permission from the king to have not only the Jewish people exterminated, but to have his old pal, his old enemy Mordecai, hanged on the highest gallows, so high that it doesn't matter where you are in Susa, the capital city, you can see the gallows. You can see where he is hanging. And so that is how it happens. But something has happened here that's another little twist in the story, an interesting twist. Somewhere along the line, there'd been a plot to assassinate the king. Old Mordecai, keeping his ears to the ground, had heard about the assassination plot, had got word to to Esther. Esther had whispered it to the king, and the king had made it, had taken the people who were plotting against him, and they had them killed, and he lived happily ever after for a year or two after the assassination plot. But nothing was ever done to thank Mordecai for this heads up. But it was recorded in the annals and the history of the people. And so, recorded in the annals of the history of the people, it just so happened that Zerk the jerk, he couldn't sleep one night. And when he couldn't sleep one night, what does he do? He asked them to bring the history book and read it to them. A lot of people would think the best way, if you've got insomnia, is to read history. And so they read the history to it. And guess what? It just so happens, It just so happens. This keeps coming up all the time. It just so happens. It just so happened. It just so happened that he began to read from the passage that explains how Mordecai was the one who discovered the assassination plot, who had whispered it to Esther, and Esther brought it to the king, and the king had been alerted, and he'd ducked a bullet there, literally, metaphorically, and he'd never thanked Mordecai. So the king says, I've got to thank Mordecai, but I don't know how to do it. It just so happened that presumably this was after a sleepless night early in the morning, that Haman had gone early to the palace, much earlier than he normally would, because he wanted permission to get Mordecai hanged on those gallows, you remember? And it just so happened when the king needs advice as to what to do to honor this person who saved his life, the only counselor who's around is Haman. And so he says to Haman, what should the king do to honor? What should the king do to honor this man who has done such a noble thing for me? And Haman thinks he's talking about him. And so he comes up with the biggest imaginable thing. Basically, he says, the only way you could honor a man like that, Your Majesty, is to give him the moon. Just give him everything. And so the king says to Haman, good, go and get Mordecai. Go and get Mordecai. And it just so happens, remember. So it goes on like this. And the not very short story, even shorter, the net result is that Mordecai gets Haman's job. He becomes number two in the kingdom. Not only that, Haman gets Mordecai's gallows, and he hangs up there on the highest gallows in the area, and the tables are completely turned. Not only that, because Mordecai is given the king's signet ring, the law that has been written and the law of the Medes and Persians could not be repealed. That's interesting, isn't it? The laws of the Medes and Persians could not be repealed. So this law that the Jews had to be exterminated could not be repealed. The only thing that could happen was this. Seeing the king has appointed Mordecai, now number two, and has given him his signet ring, Mordecai is in a position to write a decree himself and seal it with the king's signet ring, and that now becomes the law of the Medes and Persians. Now go figure that out, or if you like, send it up to Washington and get them to figure it out. But what happened was this, the whole thing is completely reversed. All right, now then, let's summarize this thing very, very quickly. Here's this story, it's a convoluted story. I missed lots out of that story. But over and over again, if you look at the story, there are incidents where it just so happened. At that particular time, it just so happened. It just so happened. And there's, well, what is it? Coincidence after coincidence after coincidence? Or is it the luck of the Jewish people? They're always dodging bullets. They've tried to exterminate them over and over again. They're still here. And they're still in positions of power. How in the world do they do it? Is it fate? Is it coincidence? Is it luck? Is it fate? Or is it possible that God, who's never mentioned in this story, is working in the background, even though he's been fundamentally ignored? And could it be that God is actually in control? That's the issue. And that's a question that all of us need to decide. When we go about our lives, what's behind everything? Is it just luck? Or is it just fate? Or is there a God who is the sovereign Lord? Well, if we go to other places in the Bible, of course, we will find that there is a very, very clear statement. And this very clear statement is this, that there is a God in heaven who is the creator and upholder of all things. I don't know if you've ever thought about this, but I'm pretty sure you've probably played the Lord's Prayer a time or two. If you prayed the Lord's Prayer a time or two, you probably ended it in words something like this: For thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever and ever. Amen. What does that mean? If you believe as you pray to God, and the beginning of the prayer is, Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom come, thy will be done. A Father in heaven who is building a kingdom whose will is done in heaven, and the prayer is it will be done on earth, is the one to whom the kingdom and the power and the glory belongs. That is what the Bible teaches. Now, I'm not just picking up on one verse. I could take you all over the Bible. I could take you all over the Bible and show you that God is described in unmistakable terms. Somebody has put it this way. When we talk about the sovereignty of God, what we're saying is God is king, he is supreme ruler, he is the lawgiver of the entire universe. He is omnipotent and all-powerful, able to accomplish his good pleasure, carry out his decreed will, and keep his promises. Now let me ask you a question. What is your life predicated on? The fact that there is a Father in heaven whose kingdom you are concerned to see come to fruition, whose will you want to see done on earth, because it clearly isn't, and we want to see it done in your life, and you believe with all your heart that he has the power and the authority and the right and the ability not only to will what shall be, but to bring to pass what his will really is. We have a choice there. And there's something else about this story that is interesting. If we take seriously what the Bible teaches about a sovereign God, and if we see that in actual fact, as it just so happened, and it just so happened, it wasn't things just so happening, it was actually God quietly working behind the scenes. And then we look at the story and we see how there were total reversals of situation. Haman knows how the man the king wants to honor should be honored. He describes it all and he knows it's going to be him. And he finishes up leading on a white horse his old enemy Mordecai, sitting there with a crown on his head and the king's robes. And talk about a reversal. And it gets worse. For he got a very nice gallows built to hang Haman, to hang Mordecai on. He finishes up getting hanged himself. How do we account for these reversals? How do we account for these coincidences? How do we account for these things just happening in our lives? I would suggest to you we take very, very seriously the words that we often say at Christmas and sometimes don't think about them again until the next Christmas. Let me read them to you because it's about time to close here. For unto us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government will be on his shoulders. And he will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Listen. Of the increase of his government and peace, there will be no end. He will reign on David's throne and over his kingdom, establishing and upholding it with justice and righteousness from that time on, listen, and forever. Now listen to this. The zeal of the Lord Almighty, the zeal of the sovereign Lord, will accomplish this. So let me ask a question. Is your life predicated on the fact that there is in heaven, sitting on the great white throne, the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords, who is ruling in the affairs of men quietly in the background, even in situations where he is not even acknowledged, is not even mentioned, nobody takes the slightest interest in him? He is still God. He is still working out his eternal purposes. This is what Scripture says of the Father and his Son. For of him and through him and to him are all things. For all things were made by him and for him, and without him was nothing made. Well, there's an introduction, if you like, a summary to the story, an attempt to identify what are the lessons that we can learn from it, and an attempt to apply it to our lives. There's just one other thing that if I had another half hour, I'd get into with you, and it is this. Whilst we can say it wasn't coincidence, and it wasn't luck, and it wasn't fate, it was God who was making things happen, there's something else patently obvious. Mordecai and Esther certainly had a role to play as well. So it suggests to us not only that God is sovereign, working out his purposes, but human beings are responsible. And that opens up another delightful can of worms. And Bill, of course, can get into that next time he comes up here. And I will come and sit and listen to him trying to untangle that. Because one of the great mysteries is this. How do we balance two things that are clearly stated in Scripture? God is sovereignly in control. Human beings are responsible to him. We see it all happening in the book of Esther. And here endeth our lesson for this morning. God bless you.